Listening to America Unchained. My name is Chris Tidwell.
And my name is Richard Dean Winfield.
We've covered the topic that is an important part of our social bill of rights, the social bill of rights agenda that you, Richard, are running on in the past, which is has to do with legal care, and particularly legal care for all. And today we're going to go into a further justification of that, run its arguments to its course, and see why it is exactly that we need legal care for all. And so most people, when they approach this concept, they might think of some sort of criminal defense, or if you run in with the law, you're going to need a lawyer for the criminal side. But I think you put forward really compelling arguments towards also needing that kind of representation on the civil side as well, which is not enshrined right now in our government or in our Constitution. And this just seems to be unfair, and a core sense of fairness if you have somebody who has a more has a stronger legal prowess. They will be able to take advantage of you in the courts and be able to either gentrify a neighborhood, or all the way from winning even more major civil cases. Yeah, these crop up in a lot of different areas. The way people interact with law, therefore, since it's not enshrined, the legal care for all for everyone, it's normally related to a monetary gain. Who has more money will buy the best lawyers, and then they'll be able to win the cases that will benefit them the most, and potentially even make more money off of those won cases. So, Richard, take us a little. This is how I see it, but take us a little bit of step backwards, and can you show us some of the flaws that you see in the system, and why this justifies a legal care for all system?
Yeah, I think first of all, one has to go back and think about the relation of legality and our rights. You know, all of our rights should be made legal. And if they're not made legal, and if we are not in a position to ensure that they are legally protected, those rights are all in jeopardy. You know, what allows rights to be made legal is that, you know, rights are not privileges. Rights are really prerogatives, a kind of circumscribed arena of choice to which you are entitled, that every other individual is equally entitled. And because of that, when you exercise your rights, in whatever sphere of rights we're talking about, you're engaging in making choices of such a kind that involve doing something that is shared by all others. They have a universal character. You're engaged in, therefore, a kind of lawful willing. This is true when you're disposing over property. You're doing something where you have a prerogative to be that individual whose property you exclusively are the person who can determine how it can be used. And in doing so, you at the same time are bound to honor the rights of others to do the same thing. Our rights of moral accountability involve the same kind of exercise of a willing that is shared by all other moral subjects. You know, we're holding one another responsible for what we do on purpose, and we're holding each other responsible for the consequences that we intended. And in doing so, we are bound to honor that same responsibility on the part of all our counterparts. If we are spouses exercising our rights to, in a sense, co-manage our household property and welfare, we're doing something that is equally shared by our partners. Likewise, in civil society, if we have economic rights, we're disposing of opportunities that are lawful in the sense that they are opportunities to which every member of civil society is entitled. Likewise, as citizens, we exercise political entitlements that are not privileges, but are shared by all other citizens. And in that respect, in taking advantage of our political freedoms, we're engaged in activities that have a general character, because all citizens are entitled to engage in those sorts of activities. So in that sense, rights are an engagement in a form of willing that is universal, that is such that all other individuals can exercise the same sort of willing without preventing others from doing the same. And in that regard, they can be specified in law, and they need to be specified in law, because we need to have some publicly accessible, authoritative specification of what the law is, which is another way of specifying what our rights are. We also need an authoritative body to judge how those laws are to be applied in particular cases, and we need an authoritative body to enforce the law. Otherwise, we find ourselves in a position where we're kind of in a war of all against all, where no one's agency has any real priority over anyone else's, and in that regard, we are not in a lawful condition. Now, so, when we speak about... Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, just so... I mean, this is extremely strong theory, and it's sort of a basic of rights in general, but some of the important points that I guess I want to pull out from that is you're talking about the universal character, and of course, Lady Justice always has kind of an equilibrium to it, and you talk about this equilibrium as well that rights must have for them to actually be powerful at the same time, so that somebody who does what they want to do can do that insofar just so that it doesn't affect other people's ability to do that as well. And the civil case in particular, the civil rights and also civil legal care, in what way is that a unique position for this equilibrium and this exercising of the will or doing what somebody wants to do?
Well, we need to think about the difference between criminal and civil law, right? There are laws that pertain to different domains. In every case, there are two broad ways in which one's rights can be violated. One can violate them in a criminal manner. And that means that the person who acts criminally knowingly violates the rights of others and does so on purpose. They are, in other words, willing against right. They know that what they're doing is wrong. And in that respect, they deserve to be punished for willing against right. And that is true even if they cause no harm to anyone. And you might ask, well, how can you engage in criminal activity without harming anyone? Because presumably you're acting intentionally, knowingly violating the rights of others. Well, any attempted crime that does not succeed would be an example of a criminal activity that has no harm that is suffered by an individual. But what is, you could say, injured is the legitimacy of right itself, because a criminal is expressly acting against what is authoritatively specified by law to be right. And for that reason, if the lawful specification of right is not to be violated with impunity, criminal activity has to be curtailed. It has to be punished. And I think it's properly come to be recognized that the appropriate way of curtailing the willing against right is by not torturing individuals, not branding them, not mutilating them. These are all activities where you strike at the body. Instead, you want to strike at the willing against right, and you do that by essentially imprisoning people, where they, in a way, are, at least for an appropriate period of time, prevented from being able to act against right with impunity. Now, on the other hand, you can suffer wrongs that involve all sorts of harms, where your rights are violated. That can occur in a criminal case, where someone does it intentionally, knowing that it's wrong. And in that case, you deserve some kind of compensation. And the compensation should presumably be provided whoever has caused that harm to occur. Now, of course, the person who has caused that harm to occur may not be in a position to provide you due compensation. But you have a right to compensation. So to some degree, the public system of legality should address that and ensure that the harm is remedied. You can also be, of course, harmed. Your person and property can be damaged, for example, and all of your various rights can be impeded unintentionally or without malice. But you still have suffered a harm. And there also can be situations where there is simply a dispute in good faith between what our respective rights are. There can be all sorts of disputes regarding about what a contract really means, or where our various property boundaries lie, or conflicts within a marriage, conflicts between employees and employer, et cetera, et cetera. You know, all of these require some kind of authoritative adjudication. And these are the kind of wrongs that are not criminal in character, but become those that fall within civil legality. And the important thing to point out is that both criminal and civil legality are of crucial significance to us. Mm-hmm. Because civil legality pertains to all the kinds of harms that we can suffer. And these can be harms that can completely transform our lives. They can involve family matters involving child custody, marital disputes of all sorts, property disputes, disputes between tenants and landlords and lenders and people who have mortgages, between employers and employees, between institutions where you receive various benefits and you think you haven't been treated properly. You know, these are all matters that come under the civil law. And obviously, it's crucial to have a fair opportunity to make use of due process and a proper legal system to uphold your rights.
And that doesn't even seem to be going on in the criminal world as of now. I mean, I can tell you, as for somebody who's just dealt with minor cases, I mean, these courts are packed, these lawyers are stressed. I mean, already there seems to be problems on the criminal side, and yet you would like to guarantee a better civil side as well. Can you maybe unpack some of the problems and what different points need to be corrected maybe in the criminal case so that we can better carry on a civil process that would be legal care for all?
Well, you mentioned lawyers, and I think it's very important to consider why we cannot defend our rights and defend against violations that are either criminal or civil in character without access to legal representation. Now it's recognized by all that a key element for a legal system to be just is that legal subjects are in a position to know what the law is. You know, there's the ancient story of a tyrant who posted the laws on top of a pole that was so high that no one could read what they were. And that obviously meant that you had no idea what you were entitled to, and it allowed the tyrant to pretty much do whatever the tyrant wanted. The tyrant could always claim, well, this is what has been decreed. Well, we need to have the law made available to everyone. It has to be published. Of course, these days can be published electronically. It can be available on the internet. That is something that can be readily managed. But the law is so vast and involves things that are so technical that the average person cannot know what the law is unless they have some expertise in how to go to look for what the law is in various specific areas. And then they need someone who has expertise to understand what the law means, because the law inevitably involves a technical character, given all of the multitude of things that it has to address. Well, for that reason, if we are going to be able to make use of the legal system to uphold our own rights and fight for our rights and get proper remedies when we are victims of criminal activity or of civil harms, we need to have access to legal expertise. We need to have access to advice by, in other words, lawyers, and also to be represented in court by lawyers, because courts themselves have all sorts of rules which have to be made legal to be authoritative pertaining to court procedures. And frankly, you need to have someone who knows what they are. That's a certain amount of expertise that you need years of study to acquire. And as I think many people know, when you go to law school, it's not so much that you're going to learn what the law is, because frankly, the law is too mammoth for anyone to know what it is. It's more you have to know how to go searching for what it is in any specific area.
You have to have the stilts to go up and see podium that the tyrants put up at the top.
Now, you mentioned the situation in criminal law.
Right.
I mean, it's worth starting there, because the United States Constitution in Amendment 6 guarantees legal representation to all legal subjects in criminal cases. And when I say legal subjects, that means both citizens and non-citizens. Anyone who is subject to the law is entitled to legal representation in criminal cases where they are accused of having committed a crime. The only thing in our Constitution that really pertains to civil cases is the Seventh Amendment, which guarantees a jury trial in civil cases where the amount of the civil matter has a value of more than $20. But there is nothing in our Constitution that guarantees representation in civil cases. Now, we have the right to legal representation in criminal cases. But the question is, do we really all have an equal opportunity in obtaining criminal representation? We all know that in our system, there are really three ways in which the right to legal representation in criminal cases is handled. Private law firms may allocate a small part of their staff to do what's called pro bono work, where they will represent free of charge someone who has been charged with the crime. Now, obviously, this is, you could say, almost a matter of charity, and it simply can't be relied upon to provide legal representation to everyone in criminal cases. It's something available only in very small amounts. There are two other ways in which legal representation is fulfilled in our system. One is by having court-appointed lawyers who will be paid a certain fee for representing a client in a criminal case. And they would be hired by someone who does not have the money to pay for a private lawyer on their own. And the court-appointed lawyer is paid a fee that is considerably less than what private lawyers will charge a client who's paying on their own for legal representation. As a result, court-appointed lawyers do not have as many resources available to investigate the case, to hire expert witnesses and the like. They simply don't have either the incentive or the resources to do as effective a job in representing a criminal client as a private individual who can pay for a dream team. On the other hand, many people who are accused of a crime who do not have money to pay for a lawyer of their own choice have to go to legal aid clinics. And these are either going to be government-sponsored and partly funded or nonprofit entities. And they also suffer a great deficit in resources. The typical legal aid lawyer has a gigantic caseload, far more than is recommended. Some will have more than 1,000 clients to deal with. And they also have very, very meager resources to engage in any kind of pretrial investigation or to hire all sorts of experts and the like. So what happens? Well, in 3/4 of the cases of legal aid attorneys, first of all, they have caseloads far surpassing the recommended maximum of having 150 felony clients and 400 misdemeanor clients during a year. They often have well over 1,000. And as a result, it's not at all uncommon for clients of legal aid attorneys to receive less than 1 hour each from lawyers who are either court-appointed or provided by a legal aid clinic. And as a result...
A private lawyer, I mean, they would be vastly higher, something like 12 to even more hours? I mean...
Well, they would... They could have as many hours as needed,
right?
Provided the client can pay for it.
Right.
And they're being paid a lot more per hour than either a legal aid attorney or a court-appointed attorney. And that that is reflected in the following rather grim statistic, that public defenders rarely file motions that contest a prosecution. They do it in only 8% of the cases. And, you know, as vile as this sounds, the truth is that in almost 1/4 of the cases of a criminal defendant who has to rely upon a publicly appointed or legal aid attorney, they first meet their lawyer when the trial begins. And to add insult to injury, in 43 of our states, clients who cannot afford to get a private lawyer are nonetheless billed fees to obtain legal aid or court-appointed lawyers. There's often an application fee to hire them that can cost between $10 to $400. And then there will be reimbursement fees. It could go into thousands of dollars. Even though these are supposed to be lawyers who are being provided at some publicly subsidized expense to guarantee legal representation. And if you can't pay the fees that are charged in order to get this supposed fulfillment of your right to legal representation in criminal cases, clients have to pay interest on loans they incur. And if they can't do that, well, they end up being fined. They can have their driver's license confiscated. They can even end up being incarcerated for not being able to pay for these fees that are levied on them in order to have the supposed fulfillment of the right to criminal representation.
So now, one of you can still go to jail, essentially.
Yeah, before you even, irrespective of what happens in the court case.
Right.
And there's another side to this that I think is worth mentioning, and we'll discuss this problem later. 95% of criminal cases in America end in plea bargaining. Now, what are we talking about with plea bargaining? What it means is that the client enters a plea of guilty. And in our system, if you enter a plea of guilty, the trial ends. There is no trial. You basically are subject to sentencing by the court. And you can call this bargaining in the sense that the defendant with the defense attorney who has provided them so little time if they don't have the money to pay for their dream team, they sort of negotiate, if you can call it negotiation, with prosecutors to arrive at some kind of sentence or some kind of settlement that this guilty plea will provide. What that means is in 95% of criminal cases, defendants do not get a proper hearing in court of the facts of the case. And it's not just the defendants who don't get a chance to have the facts of the case properly investigated, but victims don't have a chance to get the facts of the case properly investigated, nor does the public find out at large. Now, you might say, okay, fine. We might want to say, okay, the case is over when a defendant admits guilt. Because one could say, in a way, we're sort of privileging what might be thought to have some special authority, namely the conscientious agreement of the accused with the verdict. But look, we all know that a guilty plea need not be truthful, right? One can make a guilty plea to protect others. One also could suffer from some kind of self-delusion or not really be aware of the facts of the case and think that one has guilt when there could be other things involved.
Right, or be entrapped by the police, or be a minor and not know the full weight of the law before you.
And of course, if we allow confessions to end the case and lead it straight to sentencing, that in a way sets up a situation where various parties will have an incentive to putting pressure on the accused to confess, because the confession will be enough to allow the prosecution to come to a victorious end. Now, think of the case of James Earl Ray, who pled guilty to assassinating Martin Luther King. Because he pled guilty, there was no proper investigation in the case of what were the actual facts. Was there a conspiracy? How did James Earl Ray, you know, end up in London after shooting MLK? Who supplied him with his money? Who was behind it all? Because James Earl Ray pled guilty, there was no further judicial investigation. And later, when James Earl Ray went to prison, he actually asked to be able to have the court sort of retry the case so that he could divulge something about what happened. But you can't do that. That's double jeopardy. Right. You know, once the case has gone through the justice system, it is over. It is over. Well, you can see in our system, you know, there's a certain problem with entering pleas. There are many legal systems, actually all the legal systems in continental Europe, do not bother with pleas. You know, a case goes to trial no matter whether or not the defendant confesses. And the confession does not mean that there's automatically going to be a guilty verdict. You still have to investigate the case. In our system, the plea bargaining, which affects 95% of criminal cases, is the highway to mass incarceration. It sends people directly to a guilty sentencing and the penalties that involves. Now, as bad as that seems, which is pretty bad if you consider the way in which our right to legal representation in criminal cases operates, it's incomparably worse with regard to civil cases.
Right. And so, I mean, I interrupted you earlier. It seems criminal cases, I mean, in the particular cases that you just cited, there seems to be some sort of disservice to a historical unearthing of facts that could be useful. I mean, you can think of countless cases that have had documentaries made about them simply just so that the word could get out. But civil cases have a less, sometimes less, flashy verdict problem. I mean, or they don't draw as much as attention. I mean, people love the good criminal mystery, but in some ways they affect more this concept of the notion of a right in general. Instead of it just being an individual, the effect that it has in violation of certain civil rights is a large abstract concept. And so could you describe maybe some of the more it's less of a physical harm and more of like a systemic harm. And could you describe the limits that have been posed in our system against that systemic harm and justice against that systemic harm?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there is, I think, this sort of common this common prejudice that, you know, criminal matters are really of a more serious nature than civil matters. You know, if you're charged with a crime, you face the prospect of a conviction that will lead to punishment, and punishment will take generally the form of imprisonment. I mean, obviously, imprisonment is a life-changing experience. And in the United States, it has consequences it does not have in other parts of the world, which we need to discuss later. One of them being that you lose your right to vote, at least while you were in prison and often later. That is not true in other democracies. But actually, civil cases can have just as significant consequences, because you can lose your job, you can lose retirement income and become destitute, you can lose access to health care, you can lose your access to education, you can lose disability and veteran benefits, you can lose housing, you can be evicted, you can be foreclosed upon and fall into homelessness, you can have your children taken away from you, or alternately, you can be separated from your parents, and you can be subject to spousal abuse without getting a proper remedy, subject to sexual harassment and discrimination on the job, and subject to unlawful disenfranchisement. And in a way, you can be subject to all sorts of problems that could be said to really accelerate the growth of wealth inequality, to deepen racial disadvantage, to intensify, in a sense, the toll of all the stresses you face if you cannot have representation in civil cases, because if you're not represented, you're going to fare much worse. Now, in America today, our Constitution, as we've seen, provides no guarantee of legal representation in civil cases. And as a result, 86% of Americans who go to court in a civil matter have no legal assistance. Now, there is a private nonprofit entity that exists in many localities, the Legal Services Corporation, which tries to fill the gap, but it by no means has the resources to come anywhere close. They have to turn away 2/3 of the people who approach them. And we're in a situation that, despite the efforts of legal services, as I mentioned, you know, almost 9 out of 10 Americans simply go to civil cases, which will completely change the course of their lives with no legal help. And I'll give you an example of what has happened. You know, we are now facing a real crisis, an unparalleled crisis of impending homelessness that may affect 1/3 of our population, well over 100 million people, because that many people failed to pay their rent or their mortgages in full last month. And the temporary suspensions of evictions and foreclosures are gone, and now people are vulnerable. Now, in New York City, to give you an example of the importance of civil representation, in New York City, this is before the pandemic, 90% of landlords had lawyers protecting their interests. 90% of tenants had no legal representation. So what happened? When they did not have a lawyer and were drawn into court in disputes with landlords, more than half the time they were evicted. When they had a lawyer, 90% of the time, they won the case and were not evicted. You know, our epidemic of homelessness, which is about to become a deluge, is in a significant part due to the lack of civil representation. And clearly, the social rights agenda really remains incomplete unless we can fight for our rights in both criminal and civil legal cases. And I think it's important to think about the Me Too movement. One thing that the Me Too movement made very evident is just how pervasive sexual harassment is on the job. Now, of course, in America, there are special aspects of our situation that allows people in power and workplaces and in political offices to harass their underlings with impunity. One is that we have reason to fear firing more than in any other developed nation. First of all, we don't have any federal job guarantee. So if you lose your job, you can't be assured of getting another job and you'll be without any income. But in the United States, unlike any other developed nation, if you lose your job, you risk losing health care for yourself and your family. So not only do you risk becoming destitute, you risk becoming deprived of any way of dealing with disease, which of course is not a good thing in the middle of a pandemic. But then the other side of it is you have no right to legal representation in civil cases. So when you have a sexual predator attacking you at a workplace, you simply don't have the resources to hire a lawyer to sue that person and get appropriate damages. And I think that's something that requires a remedy, as does our predicament whenever we suffer harms of any kind. And civil cases are really those cases in which we can try to get proper compensation for all of the harms that we suffer. And obviously, if hiring a lawyer depends upon how much money you have, the fact that those with less money cannot defend themselves in court, either with equal quality legal representation in criminal cases or with any kind of legal representation in civil cases, that means that our legal system as it stands is not just perpetuating wealth and income inequality and entrenched racial and gender disadvantage, it is deepening all of them.
And we live in America, which has such a lawsuit-happy culture about it. I mean, our president is maybe the best example of this. If he doesn't like something, he threatens to sue over it. And it becomes this power play where they have more money, so they can then abuse that fact to potentially gain legal power and therefore infringe on rights of other people just based off of how much cash they can put down. And I mean, it's not unrelated, the fact that he feels empowered to sexually harass somebody, and he knows that he can win potentially a legal case over that. And so it doesn't seem to be a fair shake at all. And civil cases in particular need to be reexamined, which...
Yeah, and keep in mind that there's another feature in our legal system that in a way perpetuates the abuse that is going on, which the inequality in civil representation in a way foments and encourages. And that is that we allow for non-disclosure agreements, which means that a perpetrator of sexual harassment, racial harassment, or of employer violations by an employer of the rights of employees, to the extent that they can benefit from non-disclosure agreements, they can avoid any publicity regarding what they've done. And the public has a right to know what wrongs have been committed and what are the outcome of cases. So, you know, an important part of in a way, establishing any kind of fair opportunity in our legal system, it would require abolishing non-disclosure agreements. But there is this fundamental problem of how are we going to provide access to legal representation that overcomes the inequalities that still afflict our system of criminal representation and the much more pronounced inequalities in the domain of civil representation. Now, many other countries have recognized that civil representation is just as crucial as criminal representation. But most of them, in fact, all of them, as far as I know, have followed the kind of route that we have taken in providing access to criminal representation. That is, they have relied upon court-appointed lawyers or something like legal aid services to provide legal care in civil cases to those who cannot afford private attorneys. Well, that sort of perpetuates the abuses we find in our own criminal justice system. Because, again, the lawyers who are court-appointed or are part of legal aid clinics that are now dealing with providing counsel in civil cases are just as overworked, overburdened, and devoid of equal resources as we find in our situation. That is not the proper solution.
In fact, we'll wind up just having more, well, we'll say those who aren't the best at in their law school, they'll wind up, I mean, if you are a particularly good law student, you aren't going to take the job that has higher hours, lesser pay, is more difficult, you see more clients, and you have to spend less time on each case and still try and get the job done as best you can and be highly stressed while doing it. That the best student, law student, is not going to take that job most of the time. And so how in what way are we able to attract the best and brightest while still being able to maintain adequate legal services, if you get what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, if you allow for this kind of two-tiered system that we have in criminal representation that other nations have tried to provide in terms of civil representation, where the poor make use of publicly subsidized services, those with more money go out and hire private attorneys. This itself perpetuates an inequality in how one can defend one's rights with the law. Now, there is another option, and it's an option that really, to my amazement, has not hit the minds of other people, despite the fact that a solution of an entirely analogous kind has become more and more discussed and more advocated, although it hasn't yet been implemented in this country, and that is the idea of Medicare for All. Because what Medicare for All does is, as we all know, at least if it were to be implemented properly, it would provide completely equal medical coverage for everyone by providing a single-payer health insurance system, which allows maximum freedom to everyone to go to any medical practitioner they want. And it also puts us in a position where we as a society can negotiate with united strength to lower the costs of medical care by ensuring, in the case of the United States, that healthcare providers and pharmaceutical companies pay the kind of reasonable fees that are charged in every other developed nation, which are half of what we pay. Now, something else can be done with regard to legal services, both criminal and civil. Namely, we have what we could call legal care for all. You know, so what would that mean? Well, it would provide a government-subsidized legal insurance program that everyone would be covered by, and it would completely cover all costs of personal, civil, and criminal advice and legal representation. And it would operate in a manner where you could go to any lawyer you want. You could get your dream team in either a criminal or civil case, and their services would be fully paid for, and you would get exactly equivalent quality and time from your attorneys as anyone else. And in addition, we could negotiate with lawyers and law firms to keep their prices, their fees in line with their actual costs and reasonable expectations for a reasonable living. And in that way, have a system that is providing genuine equal opportunity with regard to legal representation, and one that is affordable And this, of course, will be good for legal practitioners. Because the 86% of people who can't afford to get a lawyer when they go before the civil courts would now have lawyers. There would be more work for lawyers. And no lawyers would be underpaid and overworked in the way in which legal aid lawyers are. They would have the same kind of caseloads as anyone else because they'll be getting the same kind of fees. They'll be able to have the same kind of resources for investigations and hiring of experts and the like. And this way, we'll really have a legal system that for once will finally be fair. And that means that everyone will be able to stand up and fight for the rights. People will be able to stand up against workplace sexual harassment, discrimination of any sort, problems with employers who are engaged in wage theft or misclassification as a way of depriving people of proper benefits and overtime pay and the like. People would be in a position to fight evictions and foreclosures. People would be in a position to ensure that their medical costs are covered and the like, and to be able to deal with family disputes and the like. And this really will be the capstone of a fulfillment of our social rights because everyone will have, in a way, an equal opportunity to get the legal representation. It's so crucial to be able to navigate the legal system successfully. And of course, it will be crucial in curtailing the impunity with which the police prey upon civilians and get away literally with murder, particularly upon people of color. Because now, finally, their victims and their families will never be lacking access to adequate legal representation to sue those who are the agents of police brutality.
And, you were talking about this being a benefit for the lawyers as well, because it's, if my numbers aren't correct, it's either a saying that goes around that there are more people in law school than there are practicing lawyers. And it's certainly a common thing for people to go to law school and not be able to find a job as easily as they once thought. This would help curtail that problem. And honestly, it's interesting for a personal stake in the game. I know plenty of people that are going to law school, and I mean, it's an option for a lot of people who are sort of interested in this political world. And the outlook that people have after law school is sometimes abysmal because you go because you think you can change the world and you can fight for what's right. But then to actually make a living, once you get out of law school, you have to go fight for a company that sometimes might have a agenda that might not be as correct as the small guy, at least from a personal ethics standpoint. So for me, I mean, honestly, this is one of the more impactful gains that I have in the social rights platform because it gives me potentially, personally, an outlook for a legal career.
Uh-huh. And I didn't realize that this was in the cards.
No, but, I mean, yeah. Sure, no, but it's hypothetically in the cards.
Sure.
The point is that for anybody like me, that's a young person that cares about the future of the United States, they can see this as a justice force, if you will, to go join. And I think that the sociology majors out there will have a lot. I'm not a sociology major, but the international affairs majors, those people that come starry-eyed into college thinking they can change the world, this would potentially be an option to continue that dream after college without selling out.
I mean, there's another side to it that is sort of identically pertinent to medical care. I think we all know that in many, many localities, many neighborhoods, which have large concentrations of poor people, you know, you find a lack of sufficient numbers of doctors or of health clinics. And part of the reason is that the people in those communities don't have the money to pay those practitioners enough for them to make it economically. And the same thing applies to lawyers. You know, there are many places where there is a shortage of lawyers because a lawyer cannot afford to make it in communities where people don't have the money to pay for legal representation. But with legal care for all, everyone has the money to pay for legal representation, no matter where they live. And I think that will also have an important role in ensuring that not only we have medical practitioners in proper supply everywhere, but we also have legal practitioners who we need. Who we need not to be overly litigious, but to fight for our rights, which we need to be able to fight for in the courts.
Right, and it comes back to sort of a core issue that you mentioned at the beginning, which is the equilibrium of providing rights and how that's an obligation by the state to maintain this sort of homeostasis with law and the civil society that relates to that law. And the goal of getting cash out of that process is not a – is in fact meant to make – all those who can't afford the best care, whether it be legal care or for civil cases or criminal cases, it's meant to put that on a playing field the same way that the rights for health are meant to be put on the same playing field when you talk about a Medicare for all. And this comes down to the question of what is the state obliged to do to ensure that their citizens have the rights that they so promise.
Now you can see that the way in which there's really a kind of perfect coincidence in the operations of Medicare for all and legal care for all. That sort of, you know, opens up the possibility of having the very same government agency handle both, and basically handle the paying out of insurance reimbursements for both medical services and legal services, and basically make it as economical and efficient as possible. But as important, as transformative as legal care for all will be, and I'm afraid to say, as pretty much undiscussed it is, I don't know of a single other candidate besides myself who is promoting it. I promoted it when I ran for Congress. Doesn't seem like it got much traction. I'm trying to put it out there this time around. Again, I haven't heard anyone yet taking up the cause, but to me, it's a no-brainer. And I would think that anyone who is attracted to Medicare for all, and by the way, national polls suggest that a majority of Americans support Medicare for all. Well, I think anyone who realizes the justice of Medicare for all should equally recognize the justice of legal care for all. But legal care for all is not itself sufficient to wipe out blockages of opportunity in accessing our judicial system. And it is necessary in order for there to be equal opportunity in the courts, in the legal system. But more must be added. And an important thing we need to address is something you mentioned earlier, and that's the problem of cash bail. And cash bail is something that in a way is so obviously obscene that no other nation in the entire world has it, with one exception, and that's the Philippines. And if you ask yourself, why do they have it? Well, it's because we kicked the Spanish out of the Philippines, you know, early in the very early 20th century, end of the 19th century, and made it a colony. And they took on one of these perversions of our legal system, namely cash bail. Mm-hmm. Now, I think we do properly recognize, as most legal systems do, that, you know, an individual is innocent until proven guilty. Nonetheless, you know, nations everywhere recognize that there are reasons to have a pre-trial detention of an individual who has not yet gone through the courts and been proven guilty, but is someone who can be regarded as a suspect to a crime, and for whom there are reasonable grounds for fearing that either they're going to abscond and not take part in a trial that should be had if justice is to be done, but also that they would jeopardize public safety. They would be a threat to public safety, including being a threat to witnesses and to evidence, which they could try to destroy. So there are grounds, you know, to put someone in pretrial detention. Of course, it should be done, you know, according to some kind of quick, timely judicial hearing. And whoever is such a suspect needs some proper legal assistance during that. But what is never warranted would be to have cash bail. And I think there are two sides to it. On the one hand, if someone is judged to be so dangerous or so likely to tamper with witnesses and evidence that they should not be let out, then they should not have an opportunity to pay cash bail and buy themselves out. On the other hand, if they're not such a threat, why should they be subject to pretrial detention? And moreover, to a pretrial detention that they're subject to for one reason and one reason alone. They don't have enough money to pay the cash bail. And in effect, cash bail is nothing other than a kind of pretrial punishment of the poor. And it is a really, it is really a very corrosive punishment. You know, there is wording in the Eighth Amendment to our Constitution, which reads as follows, namely, excessive bail shall not be required. Well, cash bail is always excessive. It's always excessive because if it allows people to buy their way out of jail, then they should not be people who are a genuine threat to public safety or to absconding or to tampering with evidence and witnesses. But if that is not the case, then they should not be in jail because they can't buy their way out because they don't have enough money. I mean, it really is a pretrial punishment to the poor who are presumptively innocent because they haven't been to trial. And it occurs with no due process. And it is something that today accounts for 60% of the people who are in jail. We have 500,000 people who are waiting a trial in jail. Almost two-thirds of them are people who are too poor to pay their bail. And they represent 95% of the jail population growth since 2000. By the way, the cost of jailing someone is on average about $120 a day. Now, by the way, if you want to think about the costs, we as a nation pay $14 billion a year to house people in jails who are too poor to pay cash bail. We are paying an extra $14 billion. On the other hand, there is a big industry of bail bondsmen. They're not these little mom and pop operations. They're dominated by 10 big corporations who have annual revenues of $14 billion and profits of almost $2 billion.
And those they're are basically one of the most dreary businesses. Yeah, I don't know if you've ever witnessed those, but gosh, I mean, you can't imagine sitting a day and doing paperwork in there. But
yeah, and think of the calamity being stuck in jail represents for someone. I mean,
right.
First of all, if you had a job, you're going to lose it, and if you lose your job, you lose income, which means you may be evicted. Your family may be evicted if there's anyone else you're connected to. Or foreclosed on, if you happen to have a house and you have a mortgage on it, right? You may lose custody of your children, right? And it can be a death sentence, as it is for people who end up committing suicide as they languish in jail with their families and themselves suffering these kind of economic calamities. And needless to say, you know, because the rate of poverty is for African Americans is three times that of whites. And similarly, for Native Americans and Hispanics, people who are languishing in jail because they can't pay cash bail, are disproportionately people of color. And you can see what it does to them and their communities. It further impoverishes them. It deepens their disadvantage and wrecks their family life. Right. And for that reason, there's no excuse to maintain it. We need to prohibit cash bail, period.
And just continuing on with the theme of this, other ways that people have used the holes in the system to make money off of, whether it be those bail funds or also, I mean, let's turn to now the profits that prisons make vis-a-vis these government subsidies that you're talking about, the spending that it costs just for cash bail. That's an inkling of the kind of magnitude of money that flows into the hands of those who are wardens of these prisons. And it's just disgusting to imagine that somebody is able to make money off of such pain and suffering, and that it is no longer the theme is no longer justice, but is profitability.
Yeah, I mean, one of the, you know, despicable features of American exceptionalism is that not only do we have cash bail, but we have for-profit prisons and for-profit probation services. These don't exist in other nations. You know, we, of course, are leading the world in mass incarceration, and also leading in private for-profit prisons. And there is a kind of connection between the two. You know, we have a quarter of the world's prisoners in our jails and prisons, despite the fact that we make up less than 1/20th of the population of the world. Why do we have such a massive incarceration, far outstripping any other nation, even the most dictatorial and oppressive? Well, we've had our war on crime, our war on drugs. The war on drugs has criminalized personal use of drugs that, if they're a problem at all, could be considered properly only a medical problem. But, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people have gone through our prison system thanks to the war on drugs, thanks to the criminalization of drug use that should never have been criminalized. And needless to say, that takes a disproportionate toll on poor people in general and on communities of color. The war of crime has done something similar because it has involved such things as mandatory minimum sentencing, to pack our prisons with people who are stuck there for longer than before. And then we have three-strike laws that have proliferated, which impose life terms for minor crimes. You know, if you've done them three times, you've had it. Again, filling up our jails. And, you know, of course, now we have jails which are facing the problem of dealing with the geriatric population of people who are languishing for the entirety of their life. And keep in mind that this mass incarceration has two very important effects concerning justice in our nation. One is that it involves a massive disenfranchisement of those who are prisoners, because in our nation, we take away the right to vote from people when they go into prison and keep it away for them in many cases after they get out of prison. And since the prison population disproportionately involves people of color, African Americans, who make up 13% of the population, 12 to 13% make up a third of prison inmates. Hispanics, who make up 16% of the population, make up 23% of inmates. They are being disproportionately disenfranchised. And I think everyone who knows about the disenfranchisement of African Americans in Jim Crow know that it was accompanied by a complete elimination of African Americans from juries. And this, in a sense, meant that both the 14th and 15th Amendments were being completely violated. The 14th Amendment, which was supposed to give people due process and the right to sit on juries irrespective of their race, and the 15th Amendment, which was supposed to give you the right to vote irrespective of race. Well, our mass incarceration, which disproportionately involves people of color, involves a disproportionate disenfranchisement, and it also involves a disproportionate underrepresentation on juries. Why? Because remember, in the United States, jurors are drawn from voting rolls. So if you can no longer vote under Jim Crow because you're black, under post-civil rights laws America, because you're in prison, you're deprived of sitting on juries. And that allows racist attitudes to operate with impunity inside juries to the extent that you do not have proper diversity. Now, we have had, through political decisions, we have permitted a for-profit corrections industry to grow in this nation. It now has more than 130 for-profit prisons. It takes in more than $5 billion in revenues each year. Now it houses 7% of state inmates, 18% of federal inmates, and 75% of immigration detainees. Now, one thing to note about these for-profit prisons, you know, you have this ideology that wants to counteract the idea that public services can be provided efficiently by state institutions. You know, there are people who want to say that me, who's been teaching at a public institution, namely the University of Georgia, for the last nearly 40 years, operates less efficiently, less productively than someone at a private university. Well, that's a lot of BS.
They don't watch college football, apparently.
Yeah. They forget that there would not be the Bulldogs.
Yes.
Without there being this public university.
Or any of the top teams.
Yeah. But hopefully we have other things to crow about besides the football, the performance of our football team.
Yeah.
But in any event, you know, it has been shown, study after study has shown, that for-profit prisons are not more efficient, are not more cost-effective than government-run prisons. I mean, that was allegedly the rationale for privatizing them, that that would be more efficient. But one thing that is true is that they are worse on all accounts than public prisons. And they are worse on all accounts because of the very nature of their business model. I mean, what is the business model of a for-profit prison? You know, it has to maximize its profits, and how does it do that? It basically keeps as many people in jail as it can and keeps them there for as long as possible. And in addition, it gives them as cheap services, as minimal services as possible, and pays its employees and has as limited a staff as it can get away with. And for-profit prisons can get away with literally murder because they are not subject to the open records laws that apply to government institutions. They are not scrutinized like public prisons. And, you know, the results are pretty unambiguous. In private prisons, you have much higher rates of violent incidents, both between prisoners, between staff and prisoners, inflicted by prisoners upon staff. And, you know, why is that? Well, first of all, you have a significantly lower ratio of staff to inmates. You have fewer prison guards, fewer prison employees of various kinds. And the staff is paid less and is less qualified. It has to undergo less training. It has less experience than at government prisons. And private prisons offer less medical care, worse food, less drug counseling, less job training, if anything, than public prisoners. You know, they cut it to the bone. They're not subject to public scrutiny. And, well, it's no accident. The people who finally get out, if they can ever get out of the clutches of private prisons, they have higher recidivism rates. Why? Because they're treated much more like garbage, and they're not in a position where when they get out, they can function as readily as from state prisons. And who are the victims? Well, you know, they're disproportionately, as we've seen, people of color and their families. And they are the ones who are suffering this disproportionate disenfranchisement and exclusion from juries. Now, there's another ugly side to it all. And again, it's part of the business model. After all, if you're a profit-seeking corporation, you have an incentive to use your wealth to get as much public influence as possible to enhance your profits. And this has been done by the for-profit correction industry through campaign contributions and lobbying efforts. And by the way, these lobbying efforts are in collusion with the American Legislative Exchange Council, the notorious ALEC, you know, which has been funded by the right-wing oligarchs, including the Koch brothers, who have been trying to flood sympathetic legislators or sympathetic bribed legislators who have been given large campaign contributions to introduce legislation that does what? Well, increases the criminalization of things like personal drug use to pack prisons full of more and more people. And all of these minimum sentencing laws, all of these three strike against you laws, which keep people in prison longer than ever. And that is what the for-profit correction industry is advocating and using its money to buy political influence. And obviously they are enemies of justice on every account. And we should get rid of them. They should be prohibited. And if anyone is unfortunate enough to be working for a for-profit prison, well, the federal job guarantee will give them a job that will genuinely serve the common good and pay them much more than they're currently making. That is starting at $20 an hour.
Right. Well, ALEC deserves a whole episode, just the kind of terrors they've provided to the legal, just legislative system in general. I mean, you have wonderful clips, I guess, terrible clips of them having these reduplicated messages that they send broad sweep to a bunch of different legislators, all with, of course, money packed on with it. And, you know, this once again is the issue is there's money having to do with the way that you treat a prisoner. It creates a product out of a human being, out of a human life, and turns them into a dividend that the shareholders can then see on some sort of report sheet. And this also carries over, as you've pointed out, even into the probation services as well. So that's even, you talked about the difficulties of people being able to get out of prison. Well, there's absolutely no way of, no shareholder benefit of them creating a service to reintegrate these people into society. So God, they're not going to do that. But they found a way that probation has sort of, in an inverse way, has allowed them to continue to suck profits out of those people who might not even be physically inside of prisons.
I mean, to understand this whole situation of for-profit probation services, which again are really unique to the United States, you have to understand what probation is. And to do that, you have to distinguish parole from probation. You know, parole is early release from prison. And in a way, it serves as something that could be spoken of as being beneficial to society. I mean, we should let people out of prison as soon as we can, you know, especially when our prisons are packed with people who are in there for things like personal drug possession. Probation is something different. Probation does not involve being released from prison. It involves being under a kind of supervision during which you avoid imprisonment, provided you comply with what that supervision demands. Now, 4.5 million people are on parole or probation. Neither of these services should really disadvantage people based on their wealth any more than any aspect of the legal system should. But if you want to understand what probation involves, it's all based upon the fact that Fees and fines have proliferated in our judicial system, and they are being applied to people who cannot pay for them. And if you cannot pay for them, you're then put on probation. Now, to understand what's involved in probation and the way in which it really involves being a kind of vampire on poor people, you have to understand what has been the situation in our system of proliferating fines and fees. You know, all of this has exploded together with the explosion of mass incarceration, all of which followed from the declarations of the war on crime and the war on drugs. You know, since then, detention or incarceration has increased 700%. And at the same time, you had politicians being more and more reluctant to use fair taxation, you know, to fund the growing costs of mass incarceration and the war on crime and the like. Instead of using fair taxation, they've shifted the burden of supporting this expanded incarceration system and system of processing people through the highway to mass incarceration. They've chosen to put the cost on those who are passing through the legal system. And who are the people who are passing through the legal system on the way to detention or probation? Disproportionately poor people, disproportionately people of color. So what you have is an entire legal system that from beginning to end has become a toll road, has become something that is preying on poor people to support itself. And in doing so, it is not only deepening their oppression, deepening their impoverishment, but it's also expanding mass incarceration. Now, if you want to look at the beginning, I mean, we have an explosion of misdemeanor fines. You know, if you're affluent, it's not a problem. You pay it. But if you're poor and you can't pay it, it can lead to a cascade of horrors. I mean, just think of an unpaid parking ticket. If you can't afford to pay for a parking ticket, you know what happens? Well, you not only have to pay for the parking ticket, you find yourself having all sorts of added fines imposed, which is a problem enough since you don't have the money to begin with to pay for the ticket. But then by not paying those fines, you can get your suspension, your license suspended. Well, that can be disastrous to someone who needs a car to get to work, as most of us do, given how lousy public transportation is in most of America. So this little thing, an unpaid parking ticket, the fines imposed, bills, can destroy the livelihood of someone. It can also involve the canceling of benefits, like subsidized housing and food stamps. In other words, you can be kicked out of public housing if you have unpaid fines, leading to homelessness. And you can't get food stamps, so you and your family suffer malnutrition, which is maybe a nice way of speaking about starvation. You suffer job loss because you don't have a way of legally driving. You could lose custody of your children because you no longer have a home to shelter them in. And then you could be subject to criminal prosecution if you try to drive to work with your license suspended. And of course, if you happen to be someone who is an undocumented person, this can lead to the wrecking of your family through deportation. And obviously, all of these things make it more difficult to pay the original fine. And the imposition of misdemeanor fines and arrests have proliferated, with the proliferation of stop and frisk tactics and so-called broken window policing, and also with the war on drugs, which has produced all sorts of fines and arrests for victimless crimes like, you know, marijuana possession. And who gets harvested predominantly by all of these fines and arrests? Well, none other than poor people and disproportionately people of color.
So these little snags turn in from a molehill into a mountain. It's like that. And particularly when it comes to money, it's this circle of at once you're not able to pay, and then those fees only just get bigger.
And to give you an idea of how the fees accumulate as you make your way through the legal system, in the District of Columbia and 43 states, you have to pay fees to have the use of a public defender, as we've seen. In 41 states, you actually have to pay for room and board in jail and prisons. In 44 states, you have to pay for parole services and probation services. In every state except Hawaii and the District of Columbia, you have to pay for GPS monitoring devices if you're let out on parole or if you're on probation. And then before all of that, as you go through the courts, you actually have to pay fees for arrest warrants. You have to pay fees for the taking of a DNA sample. And then there are court costs fees. What does this mean? It means to support the salaries of the court, the utilities and facilities. There are even charges for having a jury trial. And then there are finally fees after you get sentenced to prison for prison services, for probation and parole monitoring. And even if you're let out and are asked to perform community service, you have to pay a fee for doing that. And then what happens if you cannot pay the fees? Well, you end up accumulating interest, further debts, and if you can't pay, you can end up actually being put in jail, despite the fact that allegedly our Constitution should be prohibiting debtors' prisons. Mm. Well, you know what happens? The proliferation of fees and of incarceration for failing to pay them ends up only increasing the legal system costs, which have elicited all of these tolls in the first place as ways of paying for this overbloated correction system that we have. And, you know, the expenses of jailing and imprisoning debtors, you know, quickly outpaces the unpaid fines. And of course, the collateral costs on those who end up being thrown back in prison of having to pay these interests is murderous on the welfare of families and the neighborhoods of those unlucky poor who simply don't have the funds to buy their way out of detention or probation. Now, to give you an idea of the extent of this, I mean, well, go on.
Oh, sure. Just what we once thought might have been far away in history is still very much real. And I think a lot of people have put a lot of good words towards the notion of these debtors' prisons. I mean, people talk about it, the use of prison labor as well as being just a continuation of a kind of slavery of sorts, where those people, particularly poor, particularly minorities, black, brown people, they are the ones actually making money for these wardens. This seems like, quintessential debtor's prison. You owe this money, you have to work for these people. So,
yeah, I had a conversation earlier today with Mariah Parker that actually is available on Zoom. And she was bringing up this issue of the unpaid labor. You know, it sort of reflects something in the 13th Amendment of our Constitution, which allegedly ended slavery, but it also, oddly enough, spoke about prisoners as being in a form of slavery or servitude. And they're treated as such. And this has happened, you know, ever since the abolition of slavery proper, that inmates have been used as unpaid laborers. And they definitely deserve reparations for that. They definitely deserve compensation for being treated like slaves. And we find that all around us in Georgia, because many municipalities are using prisoners without paying them anything. And of course, after Reconstruction folded and you had a resurgence of white supremacy, police would go around looking for black people they could pick up. And they would then imprison them and then hire and then sort of give them to, plantations to be used as unpaid prison labor. Now, today, when people get out of prison in this country, 66% of them Well, I shouldn't say that. Today, 85% of inmates leaving prison are entrapped in the shackles of debt that they owe to one part or another of their journey through the justice system. In Philadelphia, to take an example, one-fifth of the population, or 320,000 people, have unpaid court debts. And that puts them ready to be scooped up by this for-profit probation services. Because what are they doing? They're acting as collection agencies for our judicial system. In other words, they operate private services where people are put on probation because they have not paid their fees or their fines. And the business model of the for-profit probation service is that this form of collecting fines and fees is to be paid for by those who are burdened by those fines and fees. And more than 1,000 courts in our country are using for-profit services to monitor the court payments of offenders that have been deferred. They're on probation. Why? Because they're poor. Because they don't have the money to pay off their fines when they were sentenced. And how do the private probation services make their money? First of all, they pay a fee for supervising those who are on probation. The fee has to be paid by those who are on probation. And if they can't afford it, then they have to pay interest on what might be advanced to them. High interest rates. And if they further can't pay these fees and fines and services and added interest expenses of being subject to probation services, which increase their debt, they can be imprisoned again, or for the first time. And who bears the cost of imprisoning them, which will be something like $120 a day or more?
Taxpayers.
We the people, the taxpayers, not the for-profit probation companies. And guess what? Georgia is the leader in for-profit probation services. Remember, we are almost the world leader in mass incarceration. Only Louisiana is ahead of Georgia in its rate of incarceration. But we are a leader in the for-profit probation services. They were inaugurated thanks to our Georgia State Legislature in 2000. Now there are more than 30 for-profit probation firms. They're supervising 340,000 Georgia offenders who make up 80% of the misdemeanor probationers in the state. And they are genuinely bloodsuckers on the poor. And they are obviously also increasing incarceration because they put additional debt burdens on those who are on probation. And they are more and more liable to have to go to prison because they can't pay their fees, even though this has been challenged at times in the courts. There was a Supreme Court ruling in 1983. It's Bearden versus Georgia. And it said that an individual cannot have probation revoked and be put out into jail due to an inability to pay a fine. But the ruling has been, to a great extent, ignored. You know, our whole justice system has become a big toll road for those who are sucked into it, predominantly the poor, whose poverty is enhanced and whose lives are made more and more disadvantageous.
So just before we head out, almost as like a review, pulling all of this together, a legal care for all platform must go towards a judicial reform agenda that includes...
Let's eliminate court fines and judicial system fees. Let's find something, some alternative way, such as community service. Let's end cash bail once and for all, like every other country has done except the Philippines. Let's get rid of plea bargaining entirely. Let's prohibit for-profit prisons and for-profit probation services. And if we do this, together with establishing legal care for all, we really can all be free and equal before the law. And this is what makes these crucial legal reforms the capstone of a social bill of rights. Because our rights mean little if we can't defend them in the courts.